Hello, my name is Andrew Pollard. Welcome to our podcast series, The Oxford Colloquy, bringing the facts, stories and people behind the science. On today's podcast, I'm talking to Sir John Bell about his role as Regius Professor in Oxford and as UK life sciences champion in helping shape the response to the pandemic, particularly around diagnostics and on Oxford University's relationship with AstraZeneca for vaccine development. Sir John Bell, GBE, Fellow of the Royal Society, Regius Chair of Medicine at Oxford and UK Life Sciences Champion. Welcome to our podcast.
Thanks, Andy, very much. Very, very glad to be here.
So I think it'd be perhaps a good place to start by saying, what is the Regius Professor of Medicine in Oxford? Those of us who work in the university have been asking that question, and so we'd like to know.
Okay. So it was a job created by Henry VIII, so it's been around a long time. And the job's migrated over a long period of time. So now its main responsibility is strategic issues in the medical school. It's not an executive position. So my only line command is my PA, Dorian, who you know well, but I don't do anything else, but I do quite a lot of strategic stuff for the medical school, and I'm freed up to do a lot of things on the national stage and on the international stage. So I've done that for many years. So it's actually quite a good job. I mean, when I was appointed into the job, I got a call from my old friend, Stan Peart, who was professor of medicine in St. Mary's. And he said to me, he said, look, JB, that it was a great news to hear you'd been appointed to that job. But just in case you wanted to know what it was, the Regius Professor of Medicine in Oxford is what the lamppost is to the dog. That puts it in some perspective.
Great. Well, that's not an image that we perhaps wanted when we think about you. John, I also understand it's appointed by number 10 Downing Street. So how does that work? And does that mean that it's a political appointment?
Well, it's not a political appointment. I think the university makes recommendations to Downing Street. And my letter of appointment came from Tony Blair. Actually, it tells you how long ago I was appointed. And it's rather fun because I'm doing quite a lot of stuff with Tony at the moment. But that's where it came from. And then you get a big scroll, which is signed by the Queen, which adds to the excitement. So it's an interesting place.
So I think we can tell from your accent that you're Canadian. And so how did you end up in the oldest university in the English-speaking world?
So quite right, Andy. I am Canada. I come from the flatlands of Canada, a place called Edmonton. And I started medical school in Edmonton and then applied for a Rhodes Scholarship. And I was fortunate enough to win a Rhodes Scholarship and came originally to read for a physiological sciences degree. And then I stayed on for my clinical medicine here. And then rather than going back to Canada, I did my postgraduate training here and then ultimately went to Stanford for about 6 years in the 1980s to get my training in immunology and genetics. And then came back right at the end of the 1980s and set up a lab and then became Nuffield Chair of Medicine in 1992. So that was the history.
So you're very focused in your career on science. But actually, I sometimes wonder how one should characterize you. You're an immunologist, geneticist, and these days a vaccine expert. So what are you?
So my background is really in immunology, and it was Andrew McMichael who sent me on my way down that road because he sent me to Stanford to work with Hugh McDevitt, who, of course, was the pioneer of immune response genes. But I arrived just at the time when the team at Stanford had started to clone genes for the first time and sequence them. And so I got very involved in cloning and characterizing HLA class 2 genes, which were involved in control of the immune response. So it was a pure mixture of genetics and immunology. And then when I came back to the UK, my lab was focused on the T-cell antigen receptor and the immunology associated with T-cell activation. But I also got involved in some of the big genomics projects because, of course, I had that genomics background. So I helped found the Wellcome Trust Center for Human Genetics and then went on to do a number of things nationally in the genetics space. So when the pandemic arrived, I was actually pretty optimally positioned because people rapidly became interested in the immunology of the virus and the and the vaccine and the effect of vaccines on immune response, and then ultimately also on the genetics of the variants. So I was pretty optimally positioned. I wouldn't describe myself as a vaccinologist, though, because you guys are mostly B-cell guys, and I'm a T-cell guy.
Perfect. Well, I mean, of course, all good vaccines do something to T-cells as well as making antibodies. So let's focus now on the pandemic. So when did you first realize that there was a pandemic? And I guess you're sitting in your role, as you said, a strategic role in the university. So watching these things unfold, when did you first realize there was a pandemic and then that the University of Oxford should have a role in it?
Well, I was fortunate because when I had the Nuffield Chair of Medicine, I was very involved in our global health program. So I was closely involved in the Khalifi program, but also the setting up of the Vietnamese research program. I was a close colleague of Nick White's. So I was back and forth and I tracked what they were doing pretty carefully. And during that, of course, I got to know Jeremy Farrow, who then came back to be head of the Wellcome Trust. And Jeremy and I used to meet and talk about a whole variety of different things with great regularity. So I was actually in Switzerland over Christmas 2019. And I remember really vividly, I got a phone call from Jeremy. And it was one of those really beautiful Swiss blue sky days, snow everywhere. So I stood out in the deck and took the call from Jeremy. And Jeremy said, JB, I'm calling just to tell you that there's trouble in China. They've got a pneumonia that looks like it's probably a viral pneumonia, and it's killing a lot of people. It's in Wuhan, and this is probably the start of the big one. So I thought, oh boy. And then he described in rather more detail how the Chinese were responding. They were moving to lockdowns, difficult to get data out of China. So that was the start. And of course, George Gao, who'd been an old postdoc of mine for many years, was running China CDC at the time. And he was very heavily involved in trying to track down the origins of this particular pathogen and what it was and where it came from and so on.
So this is in December still or in early January now?
No, this was December. So the message came through before the 1st of January, but there was nobody knew what was going on. So it was possible this would be an outbreak, a bit like some of the other outbreaks of SARS in Asia, but it was also possible it was going to be a bigger and more explosive pandemic. And the early news out of China was that it was spreading quite quickly and quite widely. So that was enough to really make me extremely anxious.
And as we move through January, it became more apparent that there was going to be more global spread, but still really until later in January, I don't think there was a full understanding of exactly what was going to then happen. How did you think then about Oxford's contribution? How could the university respond? Were you already aware of the possibilities?
Yeah, so it was pretty clear to me that there was a lot of expertise in the university that could be pretty useful if this thing blew up. And it, as you remember, there were many of us who had been warning of the risks of a serious pandemic over many years. I can remember talking about this 25 years ago, saying if you looked at the risk register for the United Kingdom, a major pandemic had to be pretty close to the top of the list. And everybody in the room would nod quietly and obviously think, oh, well, he's a bit crazy. But anyway, there were a few of us who had been saying, be a bit careful about this. And of course, the experience with avian flu was that it wasn't transmissible between humans, but its very high mortality rate did send shivers up and down your spine if you thought that that would get away on us. So I, of course, had also been very actively involved in supporting the development of vaccine platforms in the university. So I had been a great supporter of Adrian Hill's when he went and captured the Jenner name out of the Jenner Institute and had built his program. I was hugely supportive of the work that Richard Moxon has done, your previous professor of pediatrics, and of course, your terrific program on typhoid and other important vaccine development programs. So I couldn't immediately think of a institution in the UK with as strong a breadth of activity in the vaccine space. And knowing that Sarah Gilbert had something in MERS that looked interesting, which we found out pretty much early in January.
So this is another coronavirus, MERS coronavirus.
And it's a close cousin of SARS-CoV-2. So that was a really important coincidence, but not a surprise because there was so much activity in Oxford across many pathogens, emerging pathogens from the developing world, that it wasn't surprising that we had something on offer. Whether it was going to be the answer at that stage wasn't at all clear, but it was still, I could see that it was in the game. And then Richard Cornell called a group of people together on, I must have been about the 20th of January, where we all got together in the Welcome Center. And I went along because I thought I'd just better go see what's happening. And, you know, it really, the room was full.
So Richard Cornell is the professor of medicine.
So that's right. He's the Nuffield professor of medicine. And there were lots of immunologists in the room. There were vaccinologists. There were structural biologists. It was a really powerful group of people, all of whom were anxious to help if this thing got out of control, which by the 20th of January wasn't clear that it was going to get out of control, although we were just getting the first noise shortly thereafter from Italy that there was starting to be a significant number of problems and that it looked like it might well be a global problem.
And we're going to come back to vaccines, but you also had involvement both within the university and externally in other areas, particularly around diagnostics. So how did that come about?
So the two major types of technology that survived the test of time in this pandemic, and let's be clear, there were about 300 people, all of whom told us that they had the solution to diagnostics, were the classical polymerase chain reaction, which is a simple amplification methodology using an enzyme and two primers. And that was really the first diagnostic test that became available based on the sequence that came out of the Chinese lab, I think published about the 11th or the 12th of January. And from that, you could rapidly develop a diagnostic test. Now, what didn't happen at that point was that the UK did not scale up its diagnostic capacities, even though we knew something was coming. There was a certain amount of complacency that this might well burn its way out somewhere over the Indian Ocean. Let's not get too excited. It'll all be fine. So by the time we got to probably early March, in my Whitehall role as life sciences champion, lots of ministers had turned to me to say, actually, we may need some help here. And I'd been brought into a number of meetings to think about how we could build up diagnostics quickly. And when we reviewed the output of the NHS Diagnostics Lab, it was very clear that the NHS was not capable of producing large numbers of PCR tests. So I think on a daily basis, it was across the whole country, it was less than 5,000. Well, you can imagine how many we needed. You know, we needed, you know, not 10 times that, but 100 times that. So on the back of that, I persuaded the folks in the room that we probably needed to set up some labs that had high throughput, that could do PCR at scale, and where you had a centralized facility where the machines could all be automated. So you bring the samples in, you could automate them, you could maintain the machines, you could capture the data, which is crucial because many of our European colleagues weren't able to capture the data, and you could maintain quality control, which is the other crucial thing because this wasn't going to work. So that was the beginning of the Lighthouse Labs. And the second thing, which was a key component of that, was that the company that I was associated with in a previous life, Roche, it was clear that they couldn't manufacture to provide us with any number of tests at scale. But I did get a call from the person from Thermo Fisher, who's another major in vitro diagnostics manufacturer, an American company. And she, I had met in my role as life sciences champion. She called me up, she said, no one at PHE will answer the phone. We've got a big supply of PCR tests. Do you want them? So I immediately called Kristen McLeod, who again had worked for me in the Office of Life Sciences. And I said, look, Kristen, we're gonna have to lean into this. And I think the government could procure a large number of tests from Thermo Fisher. And in fact, what saved the country in the first 3 months was access to a large number of tests and the creation of those three big lighthouse labs, one in Glasgow, one in Macclesfield, and one in Milton.
Milton Keynes. So these were the PCR tests when people were going to these PCR centres to have a test. They would then be shipped off to these lighthouse labs and get the result back rapidly.
That's exactly right. But it comes off your tongue really easily, Andy. But let me tell you, if you tried to set something like that up from scratch with starting with nothing, that was a really big lift. And, you know, to the credit of some of the civil servants involved, they really did some impressive things. So, for example, we sent the army out to every university we could find to requisition all their PCR machines, because, of course, you couldn't get 300 PCR machines from anywhere except people who already had them. So we had to get those in place. The automation was really hard, getting the staff in place, managing it from a safety perspective and PPE for everybody involved. Because remember, these were flowing tens of thousands of infected swabs through the system.
And during lockdowns as well.
And it was during lockdowns. I mean, boy, oh boy, it was. And so I was on the phone 12 hours of every day, just talking to people, getting stuff lined up, organizing the automation, helping the guys leading the different labs. So that was a really big lift, but it was a really big success. And I think was overshadowed a little bit by, I mean, Matt Hancock was very supportive of this, but he kind of put himself out there by saying, we're going to have 100,000 tests a day by the end of April, I think it was. And then after he'd said it, he called me up. He said, is that the right number?
But as you say, eventually this
we got there.
The range of testing, and probably more than almost any other country in the world.
Well, after that, I got phone calls from everybody. I got phone calls from the Australians. I got phone calls from people saying, how the heck did you do that? We're going to do the same here, because getting scaled up testing, but not just that, but getting it linked into a data system where you capture the data, you link it to the patient, you know who's infected and who isn't infected. That was not a trivial task. And the other person very supportive was Lord Bethel, who I worked with very carefully. And, you know, neither Matt or James were scientists, so they were relying very heavily on advice they got from me and others to try and get this thing scaled up. But it was that was a very big lift, but it was hugely successful. And of course, in the end, developing it over then the next 18 months, the PCR capacity in the country was almost 1 million tests a day. I mean, it was unbelievable, actually, if you think about it.
Yeah, it's an absolutely enormous effort to do that. And of course, there's the other end of testing, which is around looking at the immune response. And diagnostic testing, just measuring the antibodies. And of course, that was also something which was done at quite a large scale, very rapidly. What was your involvement there?
Yeah, so there we had a lot of help from David Stewart and the team at Diamond, which is the big crystallography facility at Harwell.
He's an expert in protein structure.
Yeah, and particularly viral protein structure. So this is exactly his spot. So it took him about 10 minutes after the sequence was published to start thinking about how we could make recombinant protein for the spike protein, amongst other things. And they were very quick to do so. And they made a very high quality spike protein that could then be used as the target to see whether people had antibodies to the spike protein, which was an indicator about whether they'd been infected or not. So he rapidly set up a very high sensitivity assay for antibodies to the virus that could tell you who'd been infected and who hadn't been infected. And that we went on and partnered ultimately with Thermo Fisher to develop that. And it turned out to be the backbone of the testing facility for the National Epidemiological Program. Others had, it's called an ELISA platform. Others had ELISA platforms. Roche and Thermo and Abbott all had ELISA platforms that were of very high quality. The initial ones, which came from smaller manufacturers, were actually not very good, and sensitivity was about 70%. You couldn't really tell what was happening, but we rapidly got to the point where those were working really well. And we did a loop. This was my first encounter with lateral flow tests, which I've become very enamored with over time. But these lateral flow tests were to detect antibodies, not the antigen. And James Bethel called me up one day and he said, I think we need a test we can let people do at home. We need an at-home test to see whether people have been infected. Because the idea then was if you'd been infected, you could go back to work. And of course, at that stage, because there was so much disease around, we thought, well, everybody must have been infected by now, so let's get those tests out there. As it turned out, based on ELISA data, there was only about 5% of people infected at the stage. So when I saw that number, my heart sank because I thought, oh God, we're going to be here for years.
Going to do a lot of testing that would be negative, yes.
That's right. But the problem was that all the little tests for this, the ones you could use at home, the lateral flow tests, that just involved a drop of blood that you could get out of your fingerprint, none of them worked. And we set up with Derek Frook, who's the professor of microbiology and infectious disease, a system for evaluating those using the serum from people, the blood from people who we knew had been infected. So, you know, the group in Bristol who'd been skiing in Austria and people who we knew had been in hospital with the syndrome. We had all those samples. We were the only people in the country because it takes, well, we thought it took 28 days to get a good antibody response. So we had to wait 28 days before we got it. But we were the only people, I think, in the country and maybe in Western Europe with a proper repository of positive samples. So we could test these. We could test the lateral flow test.
The different kits, yeah.
The different kits. And it turned out, of course, that the majority of them didn't work very well at all. And there were literally hundreds of them. I ran a meeting every week with the team from the Department of Health. And, you know, we probably looked at 20 every week and essentially none of them worked. So that was not a great moment. In the end, we realized that probably the big lab-based ELISAs, the ones that had come from the big manufacturers, were going to be the way to do that.
So how did the link with AstraZeneca start? I mean, this was Oxford University eventually partnered with AstraZeneca in the development of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine, which had, as you mentioned, the prototype was there from Dame Sarah Gilbert, who'd worked on MERS coronavirus. But then we critically, as a university doing development, needed an industrial partner. There was no way we could distribute to every corner of the world.
Yeah. So that, I mean, I think that last statement is where I started to enter the fray. I was obviously tracking what was happening carefully. But I then realized that actually, if there was a real pandemic, and it was clear by the time I got very involved that there was clearly going to be a major global health crisis, that we as a university had no real capacity to scale manufacturing, to do all the regulatory things that would need to be done across multiple jurisdictions, and to actually get this out to people at scale. And I think that was particularly true because this vaccine at that stage looked like it might well be the only runner. Because although we knew about the RNA vaccines, of course, they were largely untested in real life. And they'd been, remember that Moderna had been working on infectious disease vaccines probably for 15 years by the time we got to this pandemic. And to be clear, they hadn't worked very well. I chair the Gates Global Health Advisory Committee, and we'd seen some data in January, that was January 2020, which suggested that they were getting good immune responses. I think it was to Zika, one of the other viruses that they've been working on, which had given us some hope that you might be able to make a response, but it wasn't at all clear that this was going to work, Andy. And as a result, I thought, boy, if we've got the only really truly immunogenic vaccine and we fall over because we've pretended as a university we could do everything that a pharma company can do, we are going to be toast reputationally. So that was not an option. So I spoke first of all to Gavin Screeton, who is the head of our division of medical sciences in Oxford, who is also an immunologist who trained with me many years ago. He's a great guy. And I just expressed my real concern about where we were going to be. And he said, no, I've got exactly the same concerns. We better find a partner for this, and we better find it quickly, because the partners are going to be drying up pretty quickly. So we went back to Adrian Hill and to Sarah, and we said, look, we need a partner, and we're happy to be pretty relaxed who that is, but we need a partner. And they accepted that that was probably true. And so we started to hunt around for a partner. And I'd had a phone call from Roger Perlmutter at Merck in late January, asking me if I knew anything about the Jenner Institute and did I know anything about the vaccine. And I'd said, yeah, it's definitely worth looking at, Roger. So I said, well, why don't we call Roger up and see whether he's interested? Because Merck, of course, is a well-established, well-known vaccine manufacturer.
And with global distribution.
And global manufacturing capabilities, big time. So we had a number of Zoom calls with Roger and his team. We talked about it. They were very cordial and helpful. Roger's a great guy. There were obviously lots of questions about the vaccine, but they weren't so fussed about that. They were trying, I think, to decide whether to go with their own strategy or whether to bring something else in. And it sort of rumbled on and on. But in the end, I also was acting as an interface, not just between companies and the university, but with government. And I think it was Matt Hancock who said to me, he said, you know, there's no way we can do this with Merck because they don't have any UK manufacturing facilities, and it'll be really hard to make that work. So I had sort of said to Roger, look, I think we better stand back from this for the moment.
Was that a concern about manufacturing in the US not being exported to Europe rather than the actual lack of manufacturing? It was the potential barrier to movement of product.
Yeah, it was the so-called Defense Procurement Act, which they'd already started to use in anger, to be honest. And we were worried about getting a hold of the PCR test from Thermo Fisher for the same reasons. And it was only because they made components of that elsewhere that we were able to jump through that hoop. But this was becoming a real threat. So onshore manufacturing was going to be a crucial bit to what we were doing. So while I was busy working on Merck, there were a couple of other suggestions that came up. I asked Patrick Vallance to talk to our friends at GSK.
And so he's the chief scientist in the UK.
That's it. And he used to be the chief scientist at GSK. So I said to Patrick, could you call the CEO at GSK? And the answer to that was that they were busy on their own vaccines, so they didn't really have time to take anything else on, which is fair enough. So I said, okay, that deal is done. We're now down really to one pharmaceutical company domiciled in the UK, and that was AstraZeneca. And Adrian and a team, I think, including Sarah, you may have been involved, Andy, as well, had gone to see Mene Pangalos and Pascal. Mene was the head of research at AstraZeneca, and Pascal was the CEO, and had quite a good conversation with them. They're not a major vaccine company, but boy, do they do biologics well. And this is essentially a biologic. Hard to manufacture, but still a biologic. So I think one of you called me up and said, look, we think that's a line. Do you want to pursue that? So that was fortunate because while I'd been at Roche, Pascal had been the head of pharma at Roche for many years. And I had spent a year on sabbatical in Roche in 2006. And Pascal had just arrived the same year I was there. And we'd spent a lot of time together. And I found him one of the most insightful and thoughtful people I'd met in pharma. And then when Roche ultimately took over the whole of Genentech, his role was to sit in Genentech and make it work as part of Roche. And Genentech, of course, is the kind of paradigm of a highly innovative pharma entity. And Pascal was terrific at that. So I knew that he was the sort of person who would do things that were unconventional, and we were going to ask him to do some very unconventional things. And the two things you guys asked me to do, which when I look back at it was completely bonkers, actually, I have no idea why I agreed to this. But you said, look, we only have two red lines. One is, if they do this, they need to do it on a not-for-profit basis. And secondly, they need to make an effort to lean into the rest of the world, the global south, at the same pace as they lean into the global north, so that the poor guys in the lower and middle income countries don't get left behind yet again. So I thought, oh boy, that'll be a tricky pitch. But I remember a Saturday afternoon when I spent most of the afternoon wandering around my garden with the phone up to my ear, talking to Pascal, and we went over all this stuff. And he said, no, no, he said, I think we can do that. And of course, it was the first pharma company that had ever had to decide how they would price the product before it had been made, because everybody else had an internal program. So they were going to price it based on whatever they thought was the right thing to do. Pascal was being asked to agree a price before we'd ever had a product. So that was pretty courageous of him. And he agreed to that.
In some ways, it doesn't make sense for a pharmaceutical company. So why do you think he did decide that the right thing to do is to go for the not-for-profit approach?
Well, I think it was partly the same reasons that the university was committed to that, and that is reputationally, we could see this was likely to be a pretty big global problem. And in fact, you could easily call it a global crisis. Nobody had ever seen this in our lifetimes. And we at the university felt it would be seen to be pretty inappropriate that we were making huge amounts of money out of the bad fortune that other people had in terms of being exposed to the pandemic. I think Pascal had the same concerns. And he also said to me, he said, the other thing is my kids would never forgive me if I started charging a lot of money for this thing. So he was completely locked into that. And I thought as time went on and it was clear that other companies were going to start charging serious amounts of money for vaccines, I thought his board would kick up a fuss, but they didn't. They supported him completely. And, you know, they really did try and stick to the agreement that we'd had to try and maintain that. And I have huge respect for that company. And I don't think they were treated very well by lots of people, despite the fact that they'd done stuff that nobody else had done in that space.
And I suppose also from a pharma perspective, if there's a pandemic on, you can't sell all your other products. So that there's also a financial incentive to contribute to ending a pandemic so that you can get on and sell all of the other products you make.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm not sure that was high on their list at AstraZeneca, but I do think they were genuinely interested in trying to make a contribution to a major global health crisis, for which they deserve a lot of credit. And of course, the other component of this was they really did lean in to making this vaccine in manufacturing facilities all over the world so it would be available to local populations. So as you know, they had a lot made in South America. You were very involved in Brazil and Argentina and all those places in South America. They were active. They had 20 sites all over the world. Of course, the best site globally was our friends at Serum Institute. And that was a connection which—
That's in India.
Yeah, which is in India. And this was a connection that came through Adrian. Adrian's been very close collaborators with the Serum Institute, who are the world's biggest manufacturing facility. And they can make vaccines for fractions of the cost that you cost you to make them in Western countries. And lots of people have been very snooty about Indian manufacturing, but the reality is they did produce the goods in this. I mean, it was a high quality vaccine. It was used widely. At peak, they were producing 250 million doses a month, which is just an eye-watering amount of vaccine. So that was all really the result of AstraZeneca doing the technology transfer to Thailand, to Indonesia, to India, to all over the world, 20 different sites. I mean, it was an amazing effort.
How unusual is it to have multiple sites for manufacturing? I mean, as you said, there are more than 20 different manufacturing sites. Is that particularly unusual? Yeah. And if so, why is it not always done like that?
Well, every time you set up a new site, it has to be approved by the regulators, and it has to follow. What you want to make sure is the product out of a site in Indonesia is the same as a product out of Brazil. And boy, that is not straightforward. And that's where this idea of technology transfer comes from, because you have a protocol, you have a stock of the same virus that you start with. But then how you grow that up to larger and larger amounts is a very, very complicated and tricky process. And I think a lot of people don't recognize how difficult that was. And most vaccine manufacturers of COVID vaccines, and I include J&J, who also had an adenovirus vaccine, they in the end couldn't produce it at any kind of scale at all. And they kind of got left behind in the race for a success. Novavax, another good example, couldn't produce the vaccine with appropriate quality control. They, you know, this is not straightforward. And I remember I had a call The biggest site in the UK was Oxford Biomedica. They too were not a vaccine company, but they had some big fermenters and they had really good people. And I knew the chairman at Oxford Biomedica pretty well. And in about September, when you were looking at the data every day, thinking, are we going to get a positive result here or not? I got this call from the chairman at Oxford Biomedica. He said, JB, I don't know whether you do this, but this stuff is really, really hard to make. And he said, we're still not sure, and we don't understand why in some vats we end up with really good virus and really good vaccine. But then the next batch, it'll be brown sludge, and they're not good for anything. So I said, oh, God, I better talk to the AZ guys. So I liaised with the AstraZeneca guys, but they were really calm. They said, no, we know all about that. We're getting it together. We're trying to share knowledge between the sites. It'll all be fine. So that was a very impressive piece of work. I mean, most products are made in two sites, maybe at most three, but make it in 20 sites is unbelievable.
So you were very involved in negotiating the deal with AstraZeneca and then stayed very close to the program through the whole of the development. How do you think working between an academic institution and Big Pharma in this way, in such extraordinary circumstances, went?
Well, I think it's not so much a commercial organization and an academic organization. You think if you have two organizations that are so involved in different bits of the program, and the pressure was pretty substantial, and I think you know that more than anybody, and that is everything you did was being tracked. It ended up in the newspaper. It was very hard to manage it in a sensible way. But not only that, but to maintain trust in the product, because that, I think, was the most important thing, is to make sure that the people on the streets who are reading the newspapers in India and Vietnam and Africa, because they were all getting this stuff poured into them on a daily basis, that they had trust and confidence in the product that was coming out of this. And as a result, there were obviously, the occasional flare of, well, maybe we shouldn't have said that, we should have said this. Communications was really hard. The Americans hated this vaccine, largely because it was a not-for-profit product, and they hate not-for-profit. And they also were a bit grumpy that none of their universities had been able to produce anything, as far as I could see, and this had come out of this little university in the back end of South England. So there were lots of reasons why they weren't going to like it. And they often behaved very, very badly in my experience. And, AstraZeneca got the brunt of a lot of that. We got a bit of a brunt of that. But look, it was what it was. I don't think you and Adrian and Sarah set out to make a vaccine for the USA, frankly. I don't think that was your ambition. They wanted a unit, that's fine. But they didn't want to use it, that was fine too. So I think that was hard, but I think it did help in the sense that we had a continual, you and I in particular, had a continual flow of information with Mene Pangalos, their head of R&D, and with Pascal. And Pascal called me absolutely regularly, sometimes to moan about how they were getting beaten up and sometimes to thank us for this and to ask us to do that and vice versa. So it was a good collaboration, and they're a really, really good company. They really should shine.
A very close relationship. And looking back now, we are more than 3 billion doses distributed around the world. And I suppose you must be feeling fairly positive about the overall thing. As you say, day by day, there are ups and downs. But overall, this was a remarkable relationship between a university and a company.
Yeah. So I don't think, I can't think of any examples of such impact from a university over such a short period of time. Now, you could argue that penicillin and Howard Florey probably has had as big an impact or a bigger impact. I get that. But over a short period of time, I don't think there's ever been such a benefit coming out of a university to human health over that sort of period. And to be honest, to be involved in the response, A, with the vaccine, but also with all the testing stuff I did, and also with the, the epidemiology and, the contributions, in the career of a clinician scientist, you don't often get a chance to make that kind of contribution. So although it was tiring, exhausting, and stressful, I do look back and think, boy, I really, that was really remarkable to be able to be part of that.
So, John, you've very nicely described that some of your experiences during the pandemic. I should also say that you've been completely fearless when speaking to vice chancellors and governments during that period, which many people who've listened to you will know that. What do you do in your spare time to try and get away from all of this pressure and attention?
So I've got to have exercise pretty much every day, otherwise I go a bit squirrely. So I did a lot of running in the pandemic. I was first a bit cautious. I live on the river, so my favorite sport is rowing and sculling, and I've got a sculling boat in the garden that I drop in the river. But early on, it wasn't clear that there wasn't quite a lot of virus in sewage. And of course, as we all know, there's quite a bit of sewage in the River Thames. So I thought, oh, I'm not so sure I'm going to paddle up and down in that thing. But after about 6 months, I thought, I'm going to go out. So I started, by the summer of 2020, I was sculling most mornings. And that was a huge relief, because when you're doing stuff like that, and I know you cycle a lot, but when you're doing that, you can forget everything else and concentrate on the sport you're doing, which has been hugely helpful.
Yes, and as you say, the finding a virus in sewage is actually quite pertinent, because it is one of the ways of tracking what happens with coronavirus and other viruses. But what would you have done, John, if you had stayed in Alberta, if you hadn't left Canada and come to the UK? What do you think you'd be doing today?
Oh, well, that's a very good question. Well, I would have probably gone on and finished medical school, so I'd probably be in the profession one way or another. I'm not sure I would have had the scientific opportunities I've had in Oxford and Stanford. So I might have ended up as a jobbing clinician, which is what I've got two brothers, and that's what they both ended up doing. I probably would have waited in Canada to receive the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine when it arrived. They didn't make a very good go of this pandemic, I can tell you that. But I'm not sure I would have ever got to the point where I was advising the Prime Minister and government in the way I have here. So it's been a remarkable journey for me, and it takes me a long way from home.
Professor Sir John Bell, thank you very much for joining us on this podcast and for making that journey from Canada to Oxford.
Thanks, Andy. Take care.
That was the Oxford Colloquy. Thanks for joining us in our podcast, bringing you the facts, stories, and people behind the science. So you might be wondering, what is a colloquy? We've called this podcast series the Oxford Colloquy. Well, a colloquy is a discourse or a conversation, and hopefully you'll agree that that's what we've been having.